G'day, I'm Osher Ginsburg.
And I'm Charlie Clawson.
We are two dads who, when we found out we were going to be dads, went looking for a podcast that could help us navigate what it means to be a dad in the modern world.
I mean, there were parenting podcasts, but they all seemed to be aimed at mums, or at the very least, mums and dads.
Yeah, there were no podcasts for dads specifically, and certainly not dads who want to be hands-on and do their share of raising their children.
So, we started Dad Pod, a podcast by dads, for dads who don't want to be shit dads.
Each week we share our own stories from the good and the bad to the thermonuclear tantrums, as well as talk with some of the biggest experts in the field to help all of us become better dads.
So if you're a dad, a mum dad, or a dad-to-be, search Dad Pod where you get your podcasts.
The following episode of FOFOP is rated MA. It contains alternating hosts, a rotating roster of guests, and mild coarse language. FOFOP advises that it is not suitable for anyone under the age of 15 or anyone who came here looking for one of those highbrow NPR-type podcasts. Minors must be accompanied by a parent or guardian. This is John Deek speaking.
Hello and welcome to FOFOP. I'm Charlie Clawson, and my guest this week is writer Ben McClay. You might know him better as Thomas Violence on Twitter. You also might know him from the Bunta Vista podcast, but you most notoriously would be known, Ben, as Brisbane's greatest shill.
Yes, that's right. Although shill sort of, to me, implies that there's, you know, a changing of hands of money going on, but I do it for the sheer joy of it. I love this city more than anything in the world, and I'm thrilled to be here every day.
I love Brisbane too. Like, I'm a Victorian originally, spent like 20 years in Sydney, and now I'm living in the Northern Rivers. But spent quite a bit of time in Brisbane. My wife works up there. She's a director, so she works out of Brisbane a lot, and I've got a lot of friends who live up there. And I was like traveling to Brisbane a lot and thinking, I dig this place. It's cool. I like the scene. It's just sort of feels like you're getting away from that Sydney and Melbourne wankery. But then I did my first summer, my first January in Brisbane, and I nearly melted. I couldn't fucking believe how hot it gets.
Yeah. And like, even people that live here will complain about that like every year, like it's a surprise. And I don't know what it is about my body. I might be the next step in human evolution, I genuinely thrive under high humidity, high heat. I feel it's like the opposite of seasonal affective disorder, I guess, or positive seasonal affective disorder. I get PSAD, where I'm just like, I'm thrilled. Every day that it's fucking hot as shit outside the house, I go for a walk and I'm like, fuck yeah, this is living.
You're the human torch.
This is great. Yeah, basically. It's just, I don't know what it is. It's nice. I feel invigorated by the thought that like even doing a simple task is kind of a life or death situation. I'm like, I'm surviving. I'm doing great.
I was staying in Brisbane for a few weeks a couple of years ago, and we were staying at the Alex Perry Hotel. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't work out why, like every other guest in the hotel, it was me and my wife and our kid, every other guest seemed to be American. And I kept getting in the elevator with these giant like bodybuilder Americans, just like humongous dudes. I'm like, what the fuck is going on? And then one day I got on the elevator and there's this big bald guy with like a little curly mustache. He looked exactly like the Iron Sheik. And I said to Jem, like, I know this won't mean anything to you, but this guy looks exactly like the Iron Sheik. And she's like, you're right. That doesn't mean anything to me. And I couldn't work out what the fuck was going on. And then I see the trailer for The Young Rock come on and I realized I was staying in the hotel with all the supporting cast of The Young Rock, who are all playing wrestlers from the 80s. So there's like an Andre the Giant, there was a Randy Savage. I couldn't.
Who the fuck do you get to play Andre the Giant? Like, that man's, you can't have a stand-in for that man.
I think they used a bit of forced perspective. He's good, the guy who plays Andre the Giant. But it's a lot of kind of putting him in the foreground of the shot and having the other actors stand behind him.
Movie magic. You can't replicate the experience of being around Andre the Giant.
Yeah, have you seen that documentary on I think it's just called Giant, which is all about, you know, his time growing up in France and then becoming a professional wrestler. And it's just it's that classic Frankenstein's monster thing where he's just like, he just wants to be left alone and fit in, but he can't. There's nowhere he can go where he is not immediately identifiable.
There's something so funny to me about him being French. Like, it's a dumb prejudice of my own, but the idea that this enormous man is French just seems like a real combination. Like, I was, for some reason, I was going through like vintage beer ads with wrestlers in them. Mm. And there was one that was for a French beer company of him speaking in French, drinking a beer in a French pub. And it's just, I don't know, it's a language that doesn't lend itself to be garbled, to being spoken by, well, yeah, by a man who can barely articulate a syllable. But like that sort of very deep voice from this enormous man is very comical.
So what, just, is that a subgenre of beer commercial? I'm unfamiliar with professional wrestlers and beer commercials.
I think it, in the late 80s, it was a very big thing. I was doing an event for a movie society type thing that I run in Brisbane, where sometimes the events we do are like clip shows of types of old weird bits of TV and movies and stuff. And we were doing one themed around wrestling, where one of the segments we were doing was just finding commercials that had wrestlers in them, which obviously there was the fucking Randy Savage.
Step into a
The Slim Jims ones. Yeah. The first one that came to mind immediately. But then a ton of beer ads, because, you know, like it's mostly...
Was Stone Cold Steve Austin ever in that? Because that was his big shtick when he was like the biggest wrestler.
Bigger guy that drinks beer.
He's the beer guy who would like get cans tossed to him in the ring and he would scull the beers. And even now when he sort of, you know, pops up and does WrestleManias and stuff, he'll still get tossed a beer. Did he do it? I mean, it seems like a no-brainer. He has his own
brand. I don't think I actually saw any, weirdly enough.
Yeah, right.
Also very funny that that's a shtick of just like, hey, this guy drinks beer, you know, like...
Well, that was his shtick, though. He was the redneck.
It's amazing.
He was the anti-authoritarian redneck. It was the Attitude Era when professional wrestling sort of shifted out of the 80s kind of superhero era and went for like a more realistic tone, which was...
A guy who wears jeans is like his
that's
thing.
Right, hates his boss.
Yeah. It's so awesome.
Yeah, I actually I got back into wrestling in a big way a few years ago, and I'm more fascinated not so much with like the what actually happens in the ring is probably the thing I have the least amount of interest in. I love the storylines and I love the characters, but I'm getting way into wrestling documentaries, like actually authentic. This is what it's like, because I try to wrap my head around like the idea of choosing that to be your career, like. Even in the United States where, you know, the WWE and now AEW are huge, you know, organizations where you can make a really good living. For the majority of wrestlers, you're not making money. So what you are doing is dedicating your life to this thing that's not really a sport and it's not really theater, but you will go and do choreographed violence, sometimes in like a hall with in front of 20 people. And I just sort of blows my mind that that is such a calling for people, and also that you have this disparity in, at the top level, you can go on to be The Rock. You can be a huge movie star, even, you know, if you're just a professional wrestler, you're rich and famous. And then at the other end is just like the guys who wrestle in front of like 20 people in a car park, and there's not a lot of kind of middle ground.
No, and it's kind of fucked as well that like these people end up being like absolute masters of a very complicated craft in terms of like, you know, the ability to act to some extent, and the physicality of it is fucking insane. And much like, you know, a lot of professional sports, these guys will absolutely destroy their body before they turn 40 to the point they can't do anything else. Yeah. But they will also only be appreciated by such a, like, by people who know, by people who are really, really into wrestling, will be able to look at what they do and be like, wow, you have dedicated your life to being amazing at something, but then, you know, the rest of the 99.5% of the population will be like, oh, these guys don't even know wrestling is fake, and they'd be completely dismissive of what this person has done.
Yeah, you're right, because the two things that they actually combine, which is the athleticism and the acting and the character building and stuff, the fields in which they should be accepted, so professional sports and, you know, TV and film and theatre, both reject them.
It's cruel.
As being some kind of embarrassing, like, you know, variation of that. But in actual fact, like, what they're doing is incredibly difficult.
Yeah, and nuanced as well. Like, I, you know, liked wrestling as a teen, then decided I was too smart for wrestling as a slightly older teen, and then... When I was in my like mid-20s, a friend of mine started forcing me to watch stuff from New Japan. Ooh. And then really also having someone just actually explain what makes wrestling good, of being like, well, the whole thing is about playing off the expectations of the crowd, because they know all the tropes. The crowd knows the stereotypes. They know the routines they do. So this whole idea of being like, well, he's pinned him two times and he's gotten out, but he's definitely going to pin him the third time. Mm. So then intentionally subverting that, and then in a way where you're kind of trying to, like, you know, like when you tease a partner and it's a form of intimacy because you know each other quite well, yeah, that you can tease them very successfully, in the same way that, like, wrestlers can deliberately annoy audiences because they know there's a level of intimacy there where they know what the audiences want and what they expect. So it's like this, it's a really beautiful thing, and it's done so skillfully. But then, yeah, if you don't kind of appreciate that fact about wrestling, you watch it and you're like, well, these guys can't act, this is shit, this is so predictable, but there's so much at play.
Yeah, it's funny, isn't it? Because it's almost what wrestling presents as, it's all broad brushstrokes. It's cartoonish acting, you know, it's cartoonish violence, it's people yelling and, you know, oversized men, you know, gigantic, ridiculous cartoonish muscles. So all of it comes across as really kind of gauche, but there's actual nuance to all of it. But it's like you're right, that New Japan, like, they are so skillful at doing long-term storytelling. Like, they will tell a story over years. So often what it's great to do for me, who dips in and out, is you just go on YouTube and you can watch a compilation, and it's like, the best bits of the last 4 years of a storyline that's resolved itself with some guy getting strapped to an electric chair and set on fire.
Oh man, you know, and they'll have storylines where they're like, this years long saga of, like, these guys that were a tag team that, it's sort of suggested that maybe they're in love with each other.
Yeah, you're talking about the, what are they called? That was Kenny Omega.
The Golden Lovers.
The Golden Lovers,
and,
yeah.
Ibushi,
yeah,
I think.
That's right.
Yeah, and where that was there's incredible. Also a slight, there's an element to it as well of, like, a sort of meta narrative there of being like, oh, is Kenny Omega gay in real life? You know, like, there's this whole thing going on, and it's just, it's larger than life, but at the same time, they're really trying to dig in these, like, quite, I don't know, they're very invested in these huge storylines, and they've done so well. And then you have the other side of it, which is like the pageantry, which you look at the Young Bucks, whose whole thing is they dress like the worst 80s wrestlers possible on purpose.
Yeah.
They steal more famous wrestlers' moves shamelessly, and, like, that's their whole thing.
Yeah.
And it's great. They take the cheesy aspects that people love and just relish in them in this really lovely way.
Have you ever thought about what wrestler you would be? Because I have. Like, I've always thought, like, would I be a better heel or would I be a better baby face? And if I had to sort of come up with a character, what would it be? Because I think often the best ones are built out of, you know, the personality of the wrestler themselves.
Like, a kernel of truth.
Yeah, Stone Cold Steve Austin is like a good old boy from Texas, you know. The Rock is this, like, obviously super cocky kind of alpha male, and all, and those personas are built out of it. And so I think that, because there's a guy called Orange Cassidy. Have you seen him? He wrestles in the AEW.
Yeah, yeah.
And his whole shtick is he's like this, like, he's like the human equivalent of a three-toed sloth. Like, he's completely laid back. He enters the ring wearing sunglasses, keeps his hands in his pockets, and never works up a sweat. Pulls off these amazing kind of moves, but always under the impression of being completely laconic and laid back. And I've always thought, oh, there's an entry level for me. Like, that's something that I could do, because I am not a natural athlete. Like, I'm not a huge muscular guy. I don't think I could adequately pull off the psychopath if I wanted to go more like a, you know, if I wanted to be like a Dean Ambrose or John Moxley kind of character. I don't think I could pull that. But I do think I could pull off the dude who's actually, is he pretending that he can't do it, or could he not do it? If I could play incompetent, turn that into a character.
I really like, I can't even think of what his fucking name is or what league he's in, which is not very helpful. But there's a guy, anyway, his whole thing is that he's essentially an annoying environmentalist, except he's being kind of sincere about it. Where he's made the, like, sustainable championship belt that he brings in with him.
Brian Danielson.
Yeah, right. Yeah, that I really like. I feel like
returned the belt was made out of wood or bamboo.
It's
or
so good.
Yeah.
I feel like that I could lean into of just being like, I am an inner city wanker. Like, I'm really annoying. I do all the shit that you hate. I've come into the ring with a tote bag for fucking 4ZZZ.
Well, you, like, could be the Brisbane guy. You could be the dude who's always going on about Brisbane. Like, when you, every time you appear in a city that isn't Brisbane, you can go, oh, God, I hate being in Sydney. I can't wait to get back to Brisbane. Boo,
oh, it'd be too easy. It'd be so easy. I watched a local wrestling show weirdly, actually, this was years and years ago, but it was a local wrestling organization in Brisbane and Regurgitator doing a show together.
That's amazing.
A hell of a combo at the former arena. But one of the, they did like a Fortitude Valley themed match during this. And one of the wrestlers was called like, it's like Randy St. John or something. And he's wearing a single like morph suit style thing. And the weapons he's using to attack people are a kebab and a dildo. And like, it was just, wow, you've nailed the theme, pal. Yeah, that's perfect.
Yeah, I went and saw a local wrestling show in Sydney a couple of years ago, and there was a heel came out, and his character was, he was a bishop, and his valet was an altar boy. And so there was just
Christ
like
alive.
Tons of innuendo when the valet was like, you know, bending over to let him through the ropes and all this kind of stuff. It was
Jesus.
Just hilarious.
Well, that's the beautiful thing about wrestling is you can use it to speak truth to power.
Yeah.
And that's amazing.
Well, years ago, I did a show at the Comedy Festival in Melbourne with Michael Chamberlain that was like about wrestling. It was just like a podcast before podcast, a live show about wrestling. Mm-hmm. And we had a character who'd come on stage and interrupt us who was the foreigner, which was just a generic, you know, generic accent, generic flag person who'd come on and just be like, I'm from somewhere else and you hate me because of that. Boo!
Yeah.
I mean, you miss the simplicity of the 80s when like the Iron Sheik or Nikolai Volkov would come
out. Oh my God.
And that would just be enough to set off a crowd.
It's so incredible to like watch that stuff where like there's two guys with like the like USSR logo on their jackets and you just like the whole crowd is like, I will fucking kill you. You're like, oh. All right. Like the Iron Sheik's perfect for just being like, I'm from Iran, pretty fucked up. And the whole audience is like, that is fucked up. That's crazy.
Yeah, we made a mistake though when we did that show is we gave out some tickets to some actual wrestling organizations in Melbourne who came to the show and they were just so rowdy. Like they treated our comedy show like it was a wrestling show. So they were fucking heckling us and like yelling, man. And like just stomping around, like to the point where I had like family and stuff who were getting really upset. One of my friends went up and tried to pick a fight with them because they wouldn't shut up. But then after the show, they were so friendly. Like that was just all part of the theater for them.
Yeah. It's so like, so that being an ingrained part of wrestling is almost being like a call and response. It's very funny watching people who don't kind of get that there's like there is a pre-written language for how this works. Mm-hmm. You know, there's things that you do, there's things that you say, there's the wrestlers are going to respond in a certain way. And then there are people that are just there to yell and get mad.
Yeah.
Like they get
up.
Too lost
you
in it.
Fucked up.
Yeah. So they're just like pointing at a guy, just being like, you're a cunt. You're like, no, that's not how this works.
Then my
you don't just insult them.
My greatest desire in life is just to have people chant at me, you are awesome. You are
awesome.
That's
the dream. We need to train comedy audiences to be like slightly more vocal and specific in their praise.
Yeah, absolutely. Hey, now can we talk about VHS tapes?
Yeah. Oh my God. Yes.
You,
absolutely.
You collect. When did this obsession start with you collecting old VHS tapes?
It would have been probably about 6 or 7 years ago of just gradually realizing that, like, I don't know. I got in at a very good time for when op shops were desperately trying to get rid of them, and tip shops would just have a ton of them because nobody wanted them anymore. Obviously, because why would you? That would be insane. Mm. And I was like, shit. That's a fun way to get cool looking physical media of the movies that I like. And then all of a sudden they became very, very expensive. And now I've been saddled with an extraordinarily pointless hobby that is also just leaking money out of my wallet now.
So is it, and I'm assuming that's due to kind of the rarity of the tape in question, the dollar
value?
Yeah.
And there's also, I mean, so when I first started buying these, I was being sort of indiscriminate in that it was just like, hey, that's a movie that I like from the 90s. And there it is on a shitty VHS that someone would have bought for $5, you know, in the 90s when it first came out. Mm. Sell-throughs, as we call those.
Yes.
In VHS biz. And then I started to get more and more specific about what I wanted, and it became gradually harder. Like at the moment, the only thing I'm letting myself spend money on is I'm trying to basically get every 80s sword and sorcery movie that was ever released on VHS. I'm trying to get all of them in very nice looking copies. I very embarrassingly, over the last week shelled out, I think, $50 and $60 respectively for two movies that I already had, but in slightly better looking copies, just for completeness sake. It's the dumbest fucking hobby. It's so stupid.
I get it. I used to work in a video store, and it's kind of one of the, you know, of all the things that we lost when physical media sort of went away, the experience of going into a video store. Like, I used to, it's such a kind of fucking hacky, nostalgic Stranger Things throwback. But when I used to close up the store, that was my favorite part, because then I would go around and I would get to pick anything off the shelves. And back in, you know, it was just a, it wasn't an independent video store, but it wasn't a Blockbuster. It was a little chain in Melbourne called Movie Land. And so they had more interesting things. And I used to love just like perusing and just taking my time, like a fine wine, picking up each of the, you know, the videos, especially like the horror and sci-fi was always the best artwork.
Oh, and incredible. Then just like,
you know, it was normally, it was a became a Friday night routine that I would finish work, close up, then I'd go around and pick, say, 5 or 6 videos. And my mates would pick me up and we'd go to one of their bungalows and smoke cones and watch, like, we had a rule that we'd like watch one good movie for one bad movie. And it was just the best.
That's as good as life gets.
Yes.
That's honestly like heaven. And especially like, I mean, it's such an old man shaking, you know, angry at the sky, whatever. Fucking, I garbled that. But like the...
You sounded like Andre the Giant trying to get that out.
Yeah. Being able to pick like anything means that you just have this sort of choice paralysis now where I will sit, you know, I'll spend fucking half an hour scrolling through all the things that I have available to me. Whereas if you were just like, oh shit, there's that one movie that I've heard of, I don't know whether it's good, a friend of mine's friend said they liked it or whatever, and the cover is cool, you kind of just have to watch it. Mm. You know, there's something nice about that. And then, I don't know, you get a more varied experience from it. And the covers are always so lurid. Mm. Like, that specifically one of the reasons why I'm so obsessed with 80s sword and sorcery movies is obviously because I smoke a ton of weed and that just makes sense. But, the covers were always these beautiful, like Boris Vallejo or Frank Frazetta artworks that were so far beyond anything that was actually in the movie.
Yeah.
They just like, they're so suggestive of something absolutely bonkers. There's this movie I really like from, it might be 2009-ish maybe, called Beyond the Black Rainbow from Panos Cosmatos, who directed Mandy. It's his first film.
Right.
Where his whole concept for the movie was, he wanted to make a movie that actually watched like what he thought all of the like horror and sci-fi movies he saw at video stores would be like based on their covers.
Yeah, right.
Which I think he nailed that brief. It's just like, it's very weird. All the imagery is like super cool and strange, but like that's kind of, you're always chasing that high of finding the thing that is actually like what those covers are like. And with those sword and sorcery movies, it's basically only true with one of them. Is the movie Conquest from 1984, which is, the front cover is a guy wielding a pair of nunchucks made of bones, and then you're like, well, the movie can't be that cool. Unbelievably cool for a good 87 minutes of nothing but pure joy. It's so good.
When I was in high school, there was a film called Recruits, which was like a Canadian knockoff of Police Academy. And the cover was like, as if it was a Drew Struzan, you know, it was like a hand painted of all the characters from Recruits. And the centerpiece was like a sexy lady in like a police uniform, like miniskirt police uniform, like suggestively holding a pair of handcuffs. And she was the most beautiful woman I'd ever seen in my life. And like, I was so kind of, because in a Catholic guilt, you know, can I rent this sinful tape? But one like afternoon, I decided I was going to rent it. And I couldn't wait to see like who this woman was, this alluring woman in the police uniform. Watch the whole fucking film and she's not even in it. Like, she's a completely, it's just a, just for the cover. And I'm like, what? Well, who is this lady? Where did she come from? And some part of me is like, did she even exist? Was this based on a real person, or did some artist just create this to torture teenage boys all over the world?
She come to an artist in a dream? Like, well, I got to put it somewhere.
Recruits has this hilarious scene where, you know, the madcap bunch of police recruits take on the local gang, and they have a showdown on this stretch of road in front of some horrible Canadian beach lakefront beach. And so they're charging towards each other on their motorbikes and stuff. And clearly you know, there has been issues with continuity, because depending on what direction the camera's pointed, the road is either soaked with water or it's bone dry. So it keeps cutting from soaked with water to bone dry as these two vehicles travel towards each other.
There was this there's this massive genre of like 80s sex comedies that purely thrived off having like, yeah, these front covers that were just like, that's the hottest woman I've ever seen in my life. And also she's nude. And then you would watch them and like 90 minutes of the worst written jokes you've ever heard, terribly acted, and then like two scenes maybe of non-sexual nudity.
Yeah.
But like, these movies cleaned up. Like, they made a ton of money, because that's what happens when porn's not that easy to get your hands on.
Yeah. And
you'll take whatever you can get.
I'm always impressed with the way they could work like a boob reveal into the story. Like in Recruits, I believe the mayor's wife is sticking her head out the top of their limousine and someone goes by on a motorbike and rips her top off. And I'm like, oh, okay, well, that makes sense. Yep. That would happen.
There you go. Yeah. You just need to do the like Paul Verhoeven method of just being like, well, in the opening scene of the movie, everyone's showering together because it's the future and that's what we do now.
Yeah. Apparently when he shot that scene too, to make the cast feel more comfortable, he stripped off naked as well. I don't know that that would make me more comfortable.
It's such a funny conception of the world to just be like, oh, that they think this is weird. Well, this will make them think that it's normal. Immediately getting your dick out. Strange man, by all accounts.
Do you have, is one tape more prized above all else?
Probably that the copy of Conquest that I had bought off this lovely Italian man who had like, well, years and years and years ago closed down a video store that he had. And this movie is, up until a year or so ago, was impossible to find on Blu-ray. You couldn't really get it on DVD. Like, the only copies of it that existed were people that had taped it onto VHS, or, you know, and then uploaded those to archive.org or whatever. Mm. And then, yeah, this lovely man on Facebook Marketplace was selling a beautiful copy of Conquest in just pristine condition, beautiful cover, in a copy that, like, it had been played so few times, it still looked better than, like, the digital version that I'd managed to find on streaming. You know? But love that movie so much.
And so in terms of tape players, like, are you living in fear? Is it kind of like Mad Max world, where once your VHS player breaks down, like, you have to learn how to fix it, because you'll be running out of people who'll know what it is soon?
So basically I'm on a system where if I see one, I buy one.
Okay.
Because they'll always have a little bit of life left in them. Like, at the moment I have one that I'm using day to day, and then I have two ready to go for when that one inevitably dies. But I have like a handwritten note with the details of one repairman on the south side in Brisbane who still does VHS repair. So if I ever get desperate, I'm hitting those guys up.
I remember when I first moved to Sydney in like 2003, I think there were probably like 1 or 2 years before iPods, but people were still using like MIDI players and things like that. And I went to a Cash Converters and they had like a Walkman, but it was like the thinnest Walkman I'd ever seen. It took cassette tapes, but it was like, and it was the thinnest thing that I'd ever seen. And I was like, I said, I don't know that this digital revolution is going to actually take off. I'm going to stick with tapes. And I remember, like, I had, like, for about 2 or 3 years, up until about 2005, I was listening to my Walkman. And people thought it was a joke. Like, people would often see me, like, take it out of my bag or put it on and think it was, like, some kind of, like, I'm doing a bit. I'm like, no, I genuinely am invested in tapes. I don't know if they're ever going to go away.
This is the future, for sure. I wouldn't worry about it.
It was such a beautiful bit of machinery. I think it was one of those ones I seem to remember in the 80s and 90s. Well, in the 90s, definitely, we had a Japanese exchange student come to stay with us. And when he opened his luggage, like, it was like an alien had like opened and was showing us all his like alien tech. It was everything was smaller and cooler looking and more beautifully designed. I remember he had this really thin Walkman and I was like, how do you get a tape in here? And he showed me where it slides in.
How does it spin? How does that work?
And I missed that.
I don't know if it's like it's probably a dumb form of nostalgia. Like, all things are, you know, like, give it another 20 years and like the AU Falcon's going to be a good looking car because it's a classic, you know, like, but looking back at the design of things like Walkmans from the late 80s and the early 90s and stuff, where There's something so satisfyingly physical about the design. Mm. Just this very square object with very square buttons, and you press it, and there's a really satisfying clunk when it locks in.
Yeah.
You know, it just, it's so tactile and so nice that, like, which is why I like, there's kind of a small spate of sci-fi movies coming out at the moment where they're making the tech look very like 1970s sci-fi movie style, where it's still CRTs, big physical buttons, physical toggles, physical switches. Something about that is so appealing. I don't know what it is. Touchscreens are just boring. Yeah, I don't want to see touchscreens in sci-fi.
But you, don't you think you see that in the way like some modern appliances, like my vacuum cleaner looks like a gun from a 1960s science fiction film. Like it's battery powered. But you, I often hold it and like, I reckon some dude, you know, who was obsessed with kind of like 60s and 70s sci-fi, because you slap in the battery like a magazine, like, you know, to operate it, you have to click a button and adjust it. Like it feels like it's fun to play with. Like I actually feel like I've got like a grown-up's kind of like toy.
I wonder about like the people who say, like someone that designs a Kmart vacuum cleaner, like the Anko piece of shit vacuum cleaner that you buy once and then it explodes and kills you. But like there are design flourishes on it, you know, like it's not a purely functional object. There is someone out there, unless they're, you know, buying them like en masse from the factory in Taiwan or whatever, but like someone had to have designed it. Someone is sitting down being like, you know what? I'm going to add a little flange to this edge on the bottom of the vacuum cleaner. That'll make it look cool. Like it's odd to me that it's a product of intentionality.
Yeah.
You know, it's someone's job.
Yeah. I often think about that with jingles. Like I often think that like there used to be the sanitarium so good. And it was like, you know, so good in your cereal, you're so good is so good is a reason why so good is so good. And then you had two backup singers going, no cholesterol, no lactose. And it used to just like keep me up at night that some professional singer who'd trained all her life came into a booth one day and harmonized with someone else on the line, no lactose.
Oh my God, imagine ending up at that point. And imagine being the guy or the person that arranged that in the first place. Yeah, it's just like, yeah, definitely. We're going to do a little chord change just before we get to cholesterol that I think will really, you know, it's bizarre.
Oh, well, I mean,
someone's got to do it.
I do get it. I mean, I do, you know, my wife and I have a production company and we pitch on commercials all the time. So there is a level of, okay, how do we weave this kind of, you know, particular reference? Like we're referencing Terrence Malick to sell shampoo or something like that.
I mean, I love that. That's,
yeah, you know?
That's like, something I want to fucking see. Just like someone wandering through a forest while their inner monologue is like, why did God give me dandruff?
Handheld, wide lens, just like through a field. Just a rambling monologue before you see Jennifer Hawkins toss her hair back.
Yeah, we've got 45 minutes to shoot this before the sun goes down. We really need to nail that take.
I've been quite inspired by your collecting of VHS tapes, and it's actually spurred me onto a new collecting habit of I've been going to a lot of op shops and bookshops and buying old books on the paranormal, because when
that's my other great love.
Oh, is it?
What have I called it? The Southeast Queensland Library for Paranormal and Psychical Research is I'm getting like paperbacks. Not well, ostensibly non-fiction books from the 70s and 80s on paranormal phenomena. It's my great love, yeah.
Oh, yeah. When I was a kid, like that was the section of the library I went straight to was always about like the ghosts and UFOs and the paranormal. And I'd sort of forgotten about it. And then I was in this little op shop in Tweed Heads and found like some, maybe it was you, some obviously like paranormal obsessed person had dumped a whole stack of books. And
oh my God,
I remember flicking through and I found a book that I had not seen since I was 8 that I was obsessed with, which is basically like an encyclopedia of paranormal phenomena. Mm-hmm. And there's the section on spontaneous combustion. It's like a black and white photo of a pile of ash and a woman's leg like tucked into a high heel on the ground. And it's like, looks like a forensic style photograph from the 50s or something with like, there's a person kneeling down next to it. I remember as a kid being like, you can just burst into flame. That happens. I'm worried about my voice breaking.
I got that from the, that same fear. I think in the opening, like the, opening credits to the X-Files, one of the like topics that flashes past is like spontaneous human combustion. I've got a book on that, actually. I think it's called Fire from Heaven, I think it's called. That's another like great like 70s, 80s paranormal paperback that I have literally hundreds of them at this point.
That's amazing.
All that happens is I get slightly too stoned to be like, all right, it's time to read one of these bad boys, read the first two chapters, fall asleep, forget everything that I read. But tremendous experience. I'd recommend it to everyone.
Yeah, it's hard though, isn't it? Like, I wanted to believe so bad before the invention of the internet.
Yeah, but then
now the problem is like something comes up and you'll research on it. And I've read so many kind of like, because I'm always fascinated with, you know, why people choose to believe in the paranormal. Because I've had friends who have had paranormal experiences and I've never had anything close to that. And I was even raised Catholic. So I feel like I'm owed a paranormal experience for the first 18 years of my life where I was forced to believe in a man in the sky. But I get really fascinated by, well, what are the scientific explanations? Like, you know, what is it about our brains, the way we interpret, you know, information that makes some people connect these things? And there's a great article that was, you know, it's like seven scientific explanations for common paranormal experiences. And one of them was sort of talking about people when they describe like an evil spirit being in a house or a sense of unease feelings of creeping dread and a very tangible sense of evil. And there's this one particular example where there was, I think it was an office building in Brazil where, you know, there was a particular floor which people didn't want to go into because they said it was haunted and people would get nauseous and feel like they were being watched. And they did all these like studies and investigations. And what they worked out was that the air conditioning unit was faulty. And it was vibrating at a specific frequency, which works on a, what's the word? It's when it's below 20 hertz. I can't remember what it's called. But it basically activates brain activity without you being aware that you're hearing like
a subsonic type deal.
Yeah, that's right. And so these people, and they were saying like the part of the brain that activates is, you know, the instinctive part of the brain that would protect you from like the sound of a rattlesnake or whatever.
So
it was really, really, it was really, really cool. But then like I sort of read that, I was like, oh, that's cool. And then it got me depressed that there are no ghosts. it's a faulty air conditioning unit.
One thing I've found has been quite useful, again, weed. Because like I'll read these books and I'll be like, holy fuck, that's fucking crazy. Like this happened to me the other night where like I was reading one and they're like, well, we found this thing in the 4th century that there's no way it could have been blah, 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 this. And then I'm like, holy fuck, that's fucking crazy. I never actually considered that. And then the first thing I did when I woke up was Googled it. And like, it was just all false. Like none of it was true. And I was like, oh shit. But for a couple of hours there, I was able to suspend my disbelief in this way where I was like, holy fuck, that's mind blowing. That's the coolest thing in the world. And I think you end up with a lot of people that never do the second step of checking. You know, like they're just like, well, I heard this thing. It's got to be true, right? Because it was written in a book by a crackpot 40 years ago.
Yeah, like the in the 80s and you know, the 90s, like you could sort of believe it. Why would it be in a library if it wasn't true? I mean, there's a paranormal investigator in England in the 30s and 40s. I can't remember his name, but it was a very famous haunted house. I think it was called Bailey Manor. And this investigator had been back 3 or 4 times. He'd written 4 or 5 books on it. And I was so obsessed, and this guy was my hero, that as like, I think I was 8 or 9, I decided to set up my own paranormal investigation business. And so, because in one of the books, he lays out, you know, he has a camera, he has some kind of like, I guess like EKG meter or whatever the 50s, 30s, 40s version of that was. His notebook, he would dust for kind of ghostly fingerprints. So I put together my own paranormal investigator's kit. That. And then went door knocking in my neighborhood and asked people, like, with no irony, like, have you had any paranormal experiences? And if so, would it be okay if I investigated? And I remember, like, most of my neighbors were like, no, we're good, and shut the door. But we had this one neighbor, Mrs. Cobb, who was not all there. And she was like, yes, in fact, I have. Please come in. And so I spent this afternoon in her house, like, with my talcum powder, like dusting for ghostly fingerprints and taking photographs of, you know, what she'd seen in her window, all this kind of stuff, just her kind of dementia and my naivety just clashing together beautifully.
That's the perfect storm of like a childhood experience. So that's like, because you like, I definitely had those flights of fancy as a kid as well, of just being like, you know what, I'm going to investigate some shit. And yeah. Then obviously you never get to follow through because who is going to indulge you?
Yeah.
Do you reckon that any of it was like kindliness on her part of being like, I will indulge this young man, or all dementia?
I think it was 90% dementia and 10% kindliness.
Great mix.
Like, I think she kind of was happy to see me in it because she lived on her own and, you know, she was, I think, kind of lonely. So I think she was happy for the company. But then there was a definite earnestness. I wish I could remember what she was describing, because I think she had been, you know, she's a bit of an odd character, and I think she'd lived with her parents, you know, as an adult, and then her parents had died and she was living in her parents' house. So there was some kind of, there was something a bit weird going on. And I don't know if she was, she may have been talking about her parents in the past tense or in the present tense and mixing the two up. And I just remember that she was showing me a lot of where she'd seen the ghosts. So she wasn't necessarily describing a horrific or scary encounter she'd had. It was very matter of fact. Oh, yes. You know, I've seen the man comes to my window or whatever it was. But I did spend a good 2 or 3 hours there. And then she gave me some horrible, horrible stale Scotch finger biscuits.
That is like the platonic ideal of like an interaction with an old person as a kid. That's like, that's everything that you would want from that.
Oh, such an innocent time. Like, I've got a daughter now. There's no way I'd get to let her go around the neighborhood just like knocking on doors and going into strangers' houses.
That'd be weird. Yeah, part of my brain is like, well, that's normal, you know. And now I think about like my friends' kids where I'm like, if I saw them doing that, I'd be like, get the fuck back at home. What are you doing? This is insane.
Well, is it, has the world got more dangerous, or is it just our awareness of the world being more dangerous?
I feel like every generation kind of feels that though, right? Like we all feel that we were living in the safer time, and like surely it can't be true all the time. Mm. You know, if it had been true every time, we would be living in hell right now. No, I mean, we kind of are, but for different reasons.
Yeah.
But like, I don't know. I don't, yeah, that's such an odd.
Well, I think our tolerance too of what is acceptable behavior has changed as well. Like, it's not necessarily that, you know, your kid's going to get molested, but, you know, it's not appropriate for a child to hang out with an adult that they don't know, you know.
Yeah.
You know, back in when I was a kid, like parents would smoke and drink in front of you and swear in front of you. And there was just like, there was a less of an idea of, oh, why, maybe we should sort of like, you know, stagger these experiences until they're at a point where they can accept them.
I mean, there's probably some changes in like just how people live, you know, like we're all, not as many people are having families. People are having families later. And like, so you end up with, you know, back when I was a kid, maybe the street that I lived on, every single house would have been a family, you know, or older people, instead of like, you know, if there was a kid randomly door knocking my street, there's just like me, a hairy 32-year-old who lives by himself, who's just like drunk on a Tuesday afternoon. Like, what? I don't, ghosts? What are you talking about? Instead of like a kindly old man. I guess, yeah.
You just less... reminded me of something else that I completely had forgotten until this moment. But I used to, my sister, I'm the youngest of 9 kids. So my sister Sophie's like 10 years older than me. And when I was like, I think 9 or 10, I just basically attached myself to, she had this friend, Morris. She went, who was like an animator. He did like stop motion animation and stuff.
Oh,
and
that's
he
awesome.
Worked in a video store, and he lived in this one-bedroom apartment in St. Kilda with just like, he had like movie posters and figurine. You know, he was just like a nerd, a prototypical nerd.
Yeah.
And I just attached myself to him like as if, oh, you're my friend now. And I would just turn up at his apartment, you know, unannounced, unplanned. And just, you know, he would let me in and I would just come hang out with him and, you know, play with his figurines and stuff like that. And he would just... he was just cool about it. And I remember, but I do remember one morning after mass, Sunday morning, riding my BMX up there, and I was looking through the window and I was like, and I could see him in bed, just like, probably hungover, just like, fuck off. Not today. Just fuck off, kid.
It's, yeah. I mean, it's definitely an odd arrangement, but also the dream as like a young nerd is to have like an older kid who is already, well, not an older kid, an older person who like already knows that dope shit and is like, you're not even ready for this, as they like show you a Dario Argento movie and you're just like, what the fuck?
He had a Nightmare on Elm Street 3 cardboard full-size standee.
Awesome.
And it was like, I mean, that to me was, it was like the Ark of the Covenant. I would covet that thing like you wouldn't believe. It was Freddy Krueger life-sized. It was amazing.
Looking at it and asking yourself, am I allowed to be looking at this? Am I going to get in trouble for having just seen it? That feeling of like looking at horror movie stuff as a kid and sort of filing it away as just like, well, that's not for me. That's for grown-ups, you know, like it's something that sort of stuck with me about specific movies for ages. Like I didn't end up watching Hellraiser until I was in my late 20s because I was like, oh, no, that'll be too scary for me. I can't watch that. I've got to wait till I'm older. And I'm like, you're 28, man. You can probably watch Hellraiser. You'll be fine.
There are certain films, though, that like, it's just like, I know it's a cliche, but The Exorcist still, like to this day, there are moments and scenes that which I'm like, they speak to that, you know, inner scared little Catholic who believed that the devil can crawl in my mouth one day and possess me. And you only need to do a horror film if a character has glowing red eyes. I freak out every time.
Yep.
Just give someone glowing red eyes and it scares the shit out of me.
That's fair. It's creepy. I think that also taps into some weird sleep paralysis thing as well, right? Where like it's a vaguely universal thing throughout human art to depict like shadowy figures with glowing eyes as like these demons, because that's something we see with sleep paralysis. Like why the Mothman looks like that. And like,
I didn't know that.
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely possibly not true, but a good theory if it is. But like there's certain kind of figures like there you find cultures that will describe sleep paralysis as like a tall, thin man wearing like a wide brim hat and shit, which is why we have like a ton of Babadook style imagery where that is so affecting because there's like some part of our brain that's just like, oh, that's the nightmare, man.
You know? Yeah.
It's creepy as shit.
Yeah. Well, that's with the sleep paralysis, isn't that they associate, you know, so, you know, 100 years ago, it would be like the demon or the witch that sat on your chest.
Yeah.
And then they reckon that morphed into alien abduction after the 1950s and all that kind of, you know, paranoia about aliens and tying it in with communists.
Yeah.
You've either
got
a communist or an alien.
There's a communist general sitting on your chest. Copy of Pravda.
Yeah, it's Nikolai Volkov. You can see he's got the red tracksuit top with USSR on the back.
It's fun because you can describe this in two ways where you're like, well, we're using our cultural knowledge to try and explain this thing that our brain does that's randomly firing off signals or whatever. Or you could be like, well, actually, this is an interdimensional experience that is tailoring itself to our consciousness. That's the smoke too much weed option, which is awesome. I love that one.
I recommend. Yeah, I mean, I've had like psychedelics where I feel like, oh, okay, I totally get it. This is the real world. Yeah, the other thing is that's the theater, that's the show. But this is how everything actually works. And I remember the first time I had magic mushrooms. Well, a mate of mine, like this is when I was like 19 or 20. My mate of mine had gone like AWOL. We hadn't heard or seen from him in about a week. And then I got a very clandestine phone call from him saying, "You need to meet me at my house at like Doc Brown calling Marty McFly. Like, meet me at the Twin Pines Mall at 11." And so I went around to his house and like his hair was like all stuck up in the air. And he's like, "I found a mushroom patch, you know, at the park near our house. Let's go take mushrooms." And I said, I've never had mushrooms. Is this going to be okay? So, yeah, it's going to be fine. So we went to this like dirty suburban park underneath the freeway and picked these magic mushrooms. Mm-hmm. And then he said to me like quite seriously as he held the mushroom up to me, he's like, "Once you take this, you'll never look at the world the same way again." I was like, "I'll be fine." And so I had like an amazing trip. It was great and really did like open some things up for me. And I broke up with my girlfriend the next day because the mushrooms told me to. It was all wonderful. Yep. Uh-huh. But he was right. I never looked at the world the same way again. And he also said that you will notice mushroom imagery fucking everywhere. And the very first thing was I picked up my Stereo MC's CD cover and it's like, "There's fucking mushrooms all over this."
I have found that one of the most persistent thoughts I get on either psychedelics or just stoned is this feeling of like, holy shit, this person made it specifically for people who are on this drug. And then, of course, the next day I'm just like, wait, no, those drugs just make everything sound very good. Like, it's kind of how that works.
Yeah. It's also that kind of, that enthusiasm, the lack of, I guess what it is, you sort of live, you lose your inhibitions. And so you are open to everything being positive and everything being great. It's like that 4 a.m. Moment where everyone's like, you know what we should do is we should get two camper vans, we should pack them up and we should drive to Alice Springs. We'll do it tomorrow. And everyone's fucking high-fiving and you start Googling where to get camper vans and stuff. And then the sun comes up and it just like takes the magic away.
You're like, I've got shit on. Like, yeah. I don't know if I can actually do that. Who's going to feed my cat? Like,
So can we talk about Bolf?
Yeah, what I'd love to talk Bolf? About Bolf. So Bolf is the Brisbane Only Rotoscope Lightning Film Festival, which is a retrospective film festival that I am doing with my best friend and business partner, Benjamin Nichols, born out of some movie events that we run called 2-Bit Movie Club, where, and this is unbelievably petty, but we had been slated to do some things with the Brisbane International Film Festival this year or last year. And then due to just some management changes and stuff, it never ended up happening. And so we were just like, all right, fuck it. We're going to put on our own film festival.
Yeah, cool, man. So for people who don't know, what is rotoscope?
So rotoscoping is the animation process of taking live action footage and then animating over the top of it. So Ralph Bakshi was a famous rotoscope artist. So like Fire and Ice and Wizards and the animated Lord of the Rings from the 70s, that was all done shooting that in live action and then tracing over the top. Rotoscope Lightning specifically is just there was this massive trend in 80s and early 90s adventure movies to put in electricity effects just done by painting, you know, frames of electricity over the top of the footage. And it looks very cool. I remember just as a kid mentally filing away every time I saw it and thinking, this is going to be a dope movie. Like, this is going to fucking whip sack. And I know it because there's cool looking electricity in it.
Yeah, there's, I mean, you're right. It's an aesthetic that is firmly planted in the 80s. Like, immediately my mind goes to like Highlander, the Wes Craven movie Shocker. I guess it's that part of that blue neon that was so fashionable. when it came 100%. To 80s genre films.
Yeah, it just looks, it has such a specific look and feel to it. And like, I don't know, part of it's just nostalgia, but it seemed like a good through line for us to do a retrospective film festival of just movies we would like to see on a big screen.
I went to your website and I was reading through the list of films and I was like, God, there's fucking more than, like, you think, oh, how detailed and how varied can this be? Well, the answer is very detailed and very varied. A lot of different filmmakers, mainstream, more independent, more B movies. Like, it really, the fact that you've identified this specific subgenre and you're able to program a festival is extraordinary.
It's just like one of those things where you have an insanely dumb idea with a friend where, you know, we had the name first. We're like, what's the worst sound that you could possibly have as your like acronym for a film festival? I'm like, Bolf. All right, what do we got? And then there's definitely enough movies there.
Sounds like Andre the Giant saying he's going to have a bath.
100%. You want it? That's like you're saying something with a mouthful of marbles. Like, yeah. We found that we've had enough movies there that if we wanted to do another couple of years of it, we could. And there are enough movies out there that we're now starting to get very annoying replies from people being like, I can't believe you forgot this. It's like, well, no, we can actually only afford to hire, you know, 11 cinema screenings.
I love, too, that it's a hot button enough issue that people will contact you. Like, outrage to let you know.
People care about it. I think it's nice in that I feel like we maybe put our finger on something very specific that people didn't realize was a specific thing. You know, they've just never put a name to it. They're just like, oh, that's that cool thing that happened in some movies. Like, yes. Yes, it is.
I've always wanted to put on a film festival where the climax of the film involves the good guy and the bad guy shooting power beams at each other.
Oh, my God. Because... Big Trouble in Little China right there.
I was even watching the latest episode of The Boys last week, and they have a moment where the good guys and the bad guys are shooting eye lasers at each other. And I'm like, this to me always feels like What is the most overt visual representation of good versus evil? It's like one colored light pushing against another colored light.
Yeah, it's like if you've reduced it down to its like most simple symbolic form possible. It's an entire narrative arc because it's always you've got your two beams representing essentially a progress bar, and then the bad guy's one gets to 60%, and you're like, oh, fuck, oh, no. And then something happens, good guy's one shoots straight to 100%. You know, like you've had
normally
your whole hero's
yells,
journey.
He yells and tenses his body, which somehow physically pushes the beam harder.
And it's weirdly intuitive. Like, I don't know if it's just culturally ingrained on us, but that just like screaming and mental effort making mind beam stronger, we're just like, yep, yeah, no, that checks out 100%. Yeah.
Hey,
it's so strange.
I saw you got the Addams Family 1 and 2.
Yeah.
It's a double feature. I can't think, where's the electricity in the Addams Family films?
I had a huge panicky moment when I was editing together the trailer for the film festival that we had put the first one in and it didn't have any in there. I was like skipping through the entire movie. I was like, no, I'm absolutely fucking certain there is. But there's a bit towards the end of the first movie where Uncle Fester is opening a book and he's doing some sort of weird magic happens with it, but it like comes out of the book and electrocutes him. And like it lasts for like 5 seconds, which we had sort of said at the start of planning the film festival that we would take the flimsiest excuse possible to justify it. Like we've got David Lynch's Dune in there as well. And the only rotoscope lightning in that movie is that whenever one of the sandworms appear, they show like 2 seconds of it sort of drawn on top of the sand for no clear reason. And I was like, well, I'm fucking screening Dune. That's good enough for me. Like, let's go.
I think that Addams Family Values is better than Addams Family. I think that is my favorite of the two. John Cusack in that film.
Yes.
But also Christopher Lloyd going through, or Uncle Fester going through his younger girlfriend midlife crisis.
Yeah.
He starts wearing like polo shirt, like blazers and polos and a blonde wig.
It's just, it's such a, like, I think by the second movie, they're very comfortable tonally with what it is they're doing. It's just, it's a little self-indulgent, but it's just so good. There's something very like naff about being like, we think bad things are good, but it's done in such a wholesome, lovely way. It's just so nice. And two,
well, Hellraiser, which you're also showing, is like, that's like the kind of edgelord version of the same thing. The Cenobites likes things that are bad.
That's it.
Adam's family do it in a wholesome way, but then the Cenobites are just all about tearing flesh and exquisite torture.
Yeah, they are kind of essentially, they have the same central conceit. I've never really thought about that. That's great.
Did you see that episode of Rick and Morty where they have the Cenobites who feed on what's Rick's dad's name? Jerry. Feed on Jerry's.
I don't think I did, no.
So it's a fantastic. So Jerry has been hanging out with these Cenobites because they get off on what a loser he is. Like every time he does something humiliating,
his delicious misery.
The delicious misery of just what a lame person he is. It's so fucking funny.
It's a fun concept if you look at it too much. We're just like, what? So your whole thing is that there are people on Earth who are, I don't know, getting into BDSM and then all of a sudden decide that the best possible thing that could happen to them would be getting torn apart by meat hooks. You're like, oh, all right. Yeah. That's pretty cool, I guess.
Yeah, Clive Barker is, I think, a weird dude. I remember reading was it Nightbreed? Whatever I don't know if the book was called Nightbreed as well. It might have been called Meridian, but it's the book that the film Nightbreed was based off. And there is this really long sex scene that happens in the book, which is so fucking gross. It's because he's dead and his girlfriend comes to visit him in jail, the lead guy. And then Clive Barker does the most detailed like description of the sex that she has with a dead boyfriend, like his dormant sperm moving from his balls.
Oh,
and it's just
God
like,
damn.
I don't want to read. This is fucking disgusting.
Authors are the people that I would trust last in the world to write a sex scene. All authors. Yeah. Every single one of them. Like, no exception. They cannot be trusted to describe sex in any way, shape, or form. It's never good. It's always just like, oh. And always slightly too revealing of themselves as a person as well.
Weird kind of fetish or something.
Yeah, very strange.
It's like a 40-year-old version where he's describing having sex with a,
bag of
like
sand.
A bag of sand.
Yeah, 100%. Wasn't there there was an Australian politician who had written a few spy thrillers that had some like unbelievably whack sex scenes in them?
Who was that? Yeah,
Dennis? Someone? No,
terrible. Oh, I can't remember. Yeah, I do vaguely remember that. Yeah, I don't. Lit erotica in literature makes me uncomfortable. I find it awkward. Maybe you've hit the nail on the head. Maybe it's because I feel like I'm getting a peek into the mind of someone whose predilections I don't want to know about. I don't think I've ever read anything that's got me hot because I'm like, ooh, Stephen King.
Man. Stephen King by far the one that I trust the least. Like, just strange man who,
once described in Christine, described the villain's girlfriend's breasts as swollen. Disturbed me so much as a teenager, her swollen breast concealed behind her bra. And I'm like, swollen?
Yeah, is she unwell? Has she had a surgery gone awry? Yeah.
All right, Ben, thank you so much for coming on the show. I'm glad we finally got to meet. This is our first time actually talking. We've communicated via Twitter. But I'd love to have you back on. And for anyone who's interested in Bolf, I'll put a link in the episode description so you can go on there and get your tickets. It's happening from Friday the 29th of July to the 7th of August, Sunday the 7th of August. Is that right?
That is 100% correct. Thank you so much.
And where is it being screened?
At New Farm Cinemas in Brisbane. Mate, beautiful New Farm.
Trendy part of Brisbane. Pretty soon. I mean, yeah, people might be able to afford to
buy a beautiful vintage cinema as well. It's a gorgeous space, but also it was the most affordable place for us to hire, so really
works out. Is
that
right?
Yeah.
And will you be what format are you screening these films from?
All just digital. Unfortunately, we did try. I fell into a really big hole of looking into the movies that the National Film and Sound Archive has on 35mm film. Got very excited to try and do that. And then realizing that I was looking into this 7 weeks before the event, and they have a strict 8-week cutoff on like when you're allowed to do it. I'd written out this massive email. I was so psyched for it. And then just reading the rest of the webpage I was already on and was just like, oh, I fucked that up. Fucked that up pretty bad.
I mean, that's a massive commitment. I worked as a teenager in a video store for like 4 years, and then in my 20s worked in a movie cinema. And so I remember like going into the projection room and being like, is this really how it's done? This is insane. These giant spools of celluloid that you have to exactly time to roll from, you know, spool one to spool two. Like, what an insane concept that for like 70 plus years, this was the dominant form of entertainment.
I actually briefly worked at a cinema as well, and I didn't get to do a lot of film projecting because it was actually kind of hard and annoying to do. I think the one that I did entirely by myself without any help was a 35mm print of Casablanca, which is one of my favorite movies of all time. So that was very nice. But I was there the night that we had... So we didn't have the two projectors switching over system. We had a brain and platter system where you put all of the reels onto one giant table, essentially. And for whatever reason, we had a film print of E.T. jump off the platter, which was something like 2 kilometers of film. We had to untangle it and wind it back on by hand. We started at like 9 at night and we left there at 7 in the morning.
That's crazy. The whole thing came off.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, no one was in the room when it happened and it just went, just so much film. It was so much. It was a brutally difficult experience, but, you know, it wouldn't happen these days. It's all digital.
Nah. The only one experience that stands up my mind working in the cinema was we had a screening of Philip Noyce's Rabbit Proof Fence.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like a private screening, so there was no public there. It was just a few staff. And I remember Philip Noyce, who's a big man, storming out of the cinema and yelling at us like, who's calibrated the sound? This is not blah, 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 blah. And this is wrong and this is wrong. And we were just like, dude, we have no idea what you're talking about right now. We just sell popcorn. He was so incensed. He had to yell at someone. So we copped it behind the candy bar.
No, that's fair. Had to go somewhere.
Ben, thanks so much for joining the show. We'd love to have you back on at some point in the future. Maybe we can check in and see how Wolf went in the end.
I would love that very much.
But for now, I'm Charlie Clawson.
I was Ben McClay.